Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business, take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
The Athletic.
Games now played and just three to go. Hello and welcome to the Zonal Marking Podcast Euros Notebook. We are brought to you by The Athletic. I'm Ali Maxwell. Four matches since we last spoke, and unlike Gareth Southgate, I'm sticking to an old school mentality of simply refusing to change a winning formula. That's both in terms of personnel, where I'm joined by the ever-present Michael Cox and Tom Warville from The Athletic, but also in structure, where like last time out and like all through the tournament, we're sticking with the tried and tested approach of previewing the semi-final fixtures while touching on keynotes from the quarterfinals. Michael Cox is here. Michael, that was a big weekend, wasn't it, of quarterfinal action, and it's a big week ahead. Are you well? Are you ready? Are you hydrated?
Yeah, all of the above. Enjoyed these four matches. I think they were all pretty good, probably aside from the England game, but I'm not going to complain too much about that being uncompetitive. So, yeah, it was good. And I think the semi-finals are set up really very nicely. I suppose it was, in the end, the four favourites from each of those games that went through. The four sides who play in white and four sides who played all three games at home, in the home country, in the group stage. So a few interesting patterns there.
Trends everywhere. Tom Warville is here as well. Tom, you still got enough battery in you to last the week?
Yeah, absolutely. The end's in sight now, isn't it? But as with international football, it always goes a bit too quickly. But yeah, really look forward to talking about these games and even watching one this week as well.
Good, good. Yes, we're at the Italy-Spain game as a zonal marking sort of group outing tomorrow night, which is incredibly exciting. And well, that's what we're going to start with, really. Let's open the notebook then. We'll talk about Spain 1, Switzerland 1 to start with. Spain won this game 3-1 on penalties. Quite a rare penalty shootout score, I think, 3-1. Don't have the stats to hand, but that's what I'm saying. What were your key takeaways, Michael, from Spain 1, Switzerland 1, Spain progressing to the semi-finals thanks to penalties?
Well, I've always got a bit of a problem when a side goes through on penalties twice in a row. I just don't think it should be allowed to happen. Happened with Croatia at the last World Cup. So I was quite pleased that Switzerland went out, really. And I actually researched the stats on this. Actually, a friend researched the stats on this. And there's been 10 times in Euros and World Cups where a side have played a second penalty shootout. And eight of those 10 times, they've lost that penalty shootout. I don't know whether that's significant. It's probably not, but I thought it was quite interesting. As for the game itself, I think more of what we've seen previously from Spain. I mean, with the exception of their final group game where they scored six goals, I've been so impressed with their build-up play, with their structure. I love the way that they use width. I think that creates a lot of space for Koke and particularly Pedri in the channels, but they still have this problem turning those chances into goals. And it wasn't just Morata in this game. I thought Morata played quite well, to be honest. Moreno came on for him and probably missed the most presentable chance they had when Jordi Alba played a really good cross or low cutback, I suppose it was. But yeah, just more of the same from Spain. I wonder whether they might change things up a little bit in the semi-final against Italy, because I thought Dani Olmo had a really good impact from the bench. Just gives them something a little bit different, drifting inside more. But it was one of those games where, if you hadn't watched it, but you had seen Switzerland previously in this tournament and Spain previously in this tournament, you can pretty much guess how it went.
When you say Olmo gives them a little something different, I'm interested in that because they have a lot of wide forwards, a lot of very talented attacking players. With Olmo, is he more direct? Is he a bigger goal threat? Better off the dribble? What do you mean by that?
I think it's almost the reverse to how Spain used to be, in the sense that 10 years ago when Spain were routinely winning these competitions, they'd often play two wide players coming inside, likes of David Silva, Juan Mata sometimes. And then they used to bring on a substitute like Jesus Navas, who had real pace going down the outside. And now they're the opposite. They start with two real one-on-one players, really, Sarabia and Torres out wide. And I thought when Dani Olmo came on, he just drifted inside more and that opened up space on the overlap for Jordi Alba. And that's not really something that we see when you have two proper wide players hugging the touchlines, going down the outside. And I mean, Jordi Alba is such an attacking threat. I mean, I think he's as good a attacking force as any of the wide players, to be honest. So just releasing him a little bit more into attack, I thought was quite crucial in Spain creating what probably should have been the game-winning goal.
That's an interesting one up against Italy as well, isn't it? Because we've discussed their sort of stable, I guess, of wide forwards as well and how a lot of their substitutes have impacted games in this tournament. Tom, we spoke on the last show about there being a few quite obvious sort of avenues of attack for Switzerland to explore against this Spanish side. One of them was delivering quality crosses towards Seferovic. Did they succeed in threatening Spain or did the defence look a little bit more convincing?
Yeah, I think what we kind of predicted in terms of how Switzerland would attack really didn't play out on the night. I mean, Zuber created no chances, created, I think, 6 in his previous 2 games, and that led to 4 assists. So they managed to kind of, Spain managed to prevent him from coming into the game and really offering much of a threat out wide. And really, a lot of Switzerland's luck had to come in transition because of Spain's dominance in possession and their high line. And I think the only real error that we saw at the back really was kind of for the goal, where Laporte and Pau Torres kind of almost ran into each other's path. Loose ball came out to Remo Freuler and then the ball gets slipped through to Shaqiri, who puts it home. So that, I think, is just, I think Michael mentioned it on a Twitter space we're doing, talking about lack of partnerships in this team. And that kind of, you know, there was obvious lack of communication, lack of thinking between the two of them there that led to that really high quality chance. So I think it was Spain's second best game in terms of shots against an XG, so they, you know, they were doing something right at the back and far less leaky, but almost those things don't really matter if you just have one big error in your team at some point in the game, which they did here.
We mentioned how many of the games in this tournament have had real shifts in momentum, have had large spells of pressure for both sides, and that makes it exciting but also quite difficult to fully analyse. And, you know, we're talking about a Spain team progressing to the semi-final, and I wonder if we probably haven't mentioned that it took penalties. You know, they didn't win this game. And this is all hypothetical. But, I mean, at the point of the Swiss red card, the game had been level for 10 minutes. There were 15 minutes or so to play, Michael. And, of course, Spain dominated extra time with the extra man. They missed a host of chances. They would have been deserved winners. But I'm interested in how differently you think that match might have played out had Freuler not dived in like that.
I would say probably not that different, really. I thought the pattern of the game was kind of similar, wasn't it? But you're absolutely spot on. And let's be honest, Spain didn't want penalties. We all know about their penalty record in over the last year or so. I think, was it 5 in a row that they'd missed or something like that? I mean, it was really, that was the Swiss objective, wasn't it, to get to penalties. And I think they are pretty well organised, Switzerland. Probably only that Moreno chance I can remember is, you know, them really being breached. A couple of kind of last-ditch blocks from Rodriguez in particular, I remember doing a really good one. But yeah, I mean, Spain just, they lack that cutting edge. And for all the brilliance of Pedri, he's got a lot of praise throughout this tournament. They aren't creating clear-cut goal-scoring opportunities. And I think that could be a problem against Italy.
The shootout itself, as mentioned, 3-1, it was just great after we saw such a high-quality shootout between Switzerland and France that in this one, 9 taken, over half of them either missed or save. I'm confident we might see a shootout in the semi-final, I reckon. Italy 2, Belgium 1 was the other quarter-final that led to this semi-final. And in the end, Kevin De Bruyne was fit to start. Hazard was not, Eden Hazard, that is. Michael and Tom, after your preview, And I said this, I felt like we're kind of leaning towards Italy edging this one. And so they did. But talk me through the sort of ebbs and flows, I suppose, of this quarterfinal.
Yeah, I thought it was a really interesting game. Pretty end-to-end, more end-to-end than I expected, considering Italy went 2-0 up. I thought they'd kind of shut down the game after that. But they definitely didn't. Or they couldn't manage to. Maybe they wanted to, but I thought they left lots of space in midfield to break into. I thought the interesting thing was, we've spoken a few times before about almost the front five that Italy create when Spinazzola overlaps to the left and Barella pushes forward in the right centre channel. And the two goals were classic examples of this. I mean, Barella almost going in behind from that right centre channel to score a really good dipping shot into the far corner. And then Lorenzo Insigne in the inside left channel, taking advantage of the fact Spinazzola was providing the left-sided width to score the kind of goal he's scored about 20 times over the last few seasons and the kind of goal he's attempted to score seven or eight times in this tournament, but a brilliant dipping, curling strike. If you watch the replay, Courtois, actually, he knows exactly what's happening. He's almost edging towards that side and still gets beaten by the quality of the strike. But yeah, it was a little bit more of the same from Italy. I thought Spinazzola was probably their best player defensively and going forward. So a massive shame that he's out for the rest of the tournament and a good few months after that as well. The thing I still slightly struggle with is Immobile. I think he's a great Serie A striker. He has rarely done it in European competition. He wasn't particularly successful when he went abroad. And I just wonder whether he's quite good enough at the highest level. I think he had a really poor game here. Struggled to hold up the ball, wasn't really getting anything from Thomas Vermaelen, who I think was excellent against both Ronaldo and Immobile in the knockout games. And obviously the injury to Spinazzola, I think, would change the way they attack quite a lot as well.
Yeah, who do they have to fill that role in the semi-final?
Well, it's looking like it's going to be Emerson. I mean, he's been... there was an argument he was going to be first choice left back coming into the tournament. I know that seems strange considering he's been third choice left back at Chelsea over the last few months. But Mancini does quite like him. He plays that role going forward reasonably well. So yeah, it's not a disaster. But Spinazzola, I mean, I would have said the best player in this tournament was Paul Pogba. When Paul Pogba got eliminated, I would have maybe changed my vote towards Spinazzola, considering how good he was in this quarterfinal. But he's now out injured as well. So yeah, I think Italy are doing without arguably the best player in the tournament so far. So that is obviously a huge blow.
That award is so up for grabs at the moment, isn't it? Just like you said, every time you think you have a good steer on who might win it, they get eliminated. And I believe I'm right in saying that certainly in the last six or seven tournaments, it's always gone to a player from the team that has won it. So I expect that trend will change. But I think the next three games will have a big say in that. Tom, your mate Doku, who you flagged up in one of our preview shows, his performance was quite something in that second half particularly.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the youngest member of the Belgian squad having to replace Eden Hazard, I think that's quite a big challenge to take on, but I thought he was excellent and, attempted 13 take-ons, eight of them were complete, and he was just an absolute live wire down the left for the whole of the game, really. And I really liked, there was an observation on Twitter by an account called Scouted Football, who do kind of scout reports on younger players, and they kind of noted how his technique of taking players on is almost like a rugby union winger, kind of like shimmies to one side and then explodes off either to the right or the left. And I thought that was a great way of kind of explaining it, really, and totally different to what you usually see with players. Maybe it's more like something skillful on the ball or look to knock it past someone and run past them, but he kind of goes more horizontally instead of vertically. So I thought Doku was fantastic. Had that one effort where he went past three and nearly got it into the top corner, which is probably the highlight of his game there, or maybe another one where he took a player on and then slipped through Kevin De Bruyne, who just missed the chance in the box as well. So I think the worry with all these kind of flashy winger-type players is a lack of end products, but I think we can see that at 19 he's already starting to develop that, and I'd be surprised if he's playing for Rennes this time next year.
Such an exciting prospect. Of course, Insigne, as Michael mentioned, he has made a living taking that shot and scoring that goal that he scored here. And as we know, those shots are quite low probability shots, but Insigne has been practicing his whole career. I was watching earlier, and this is why this podcast and being on it is brilliant, because as research this morning, I watched all 20 of Insigne's goals for Pescara in Serie B in 2011-12, and it's incredible how often he scored that exact same goal. In fact, as single season highlights reels go, I mean, for a 19-year-old or 20-year-old to be doing what he did, albeit in the second tier, it's definitely worth a watch. Incredible compilation of goals that you can find on YouTube. Stu James has written a great piece, by the way, about Italy's gamesmanship, for want of a better word, the headline stat being that in the last 21 minutes of that match, the ball was only in play for 9 of them. So, you know, should Italy go ahead in the semi-final, that is something that Spain will have to cope with and make sure they keep their heads. In a tactical sense, this semi-final between Spain and Italy, obviously a repeat of the 2012 final. And tactically, Michael, 4-3-3 against 4-3-3, the highest possession team in the tournament in terms of Spain versus the third highest in Italy. What's this game going to look like, do you think, tactically?
That's a good question. I think Spain are probably more committed to possession dominance than Italy. I think Italy probably do have an element of them that is a little bit happier to sit back. I think they've maybe got more counter-attacking potential as well with Chiesa. Barella is a great forward runner. I think, unusually for a central midfielder, I think he's happiest when he's playing on the counter-attack. But yeah, I would slightly favour Italy. And it comes back to what Tom mentioned before about the lack of partnership, particularly at centre-back. I mean, we saw that with the goal Spain conceded. There's just no relationship there. And you compare that to Chiellini and Bonucci, who've played together at club level for 10 years. I think there's a massive difference there. And I think I'd be surprised if this wasn't tight. It feels to me like this is a 1-0 game or something like that. And I would just back Italy's defence to make fewer errors than Spain's defence here.
Tom, I feel like you've been, of the three of us, the biggest Spain fan in this tournament so far. Any rebuttal from what Michael thinks? You've got more hope for the Spaniards?
I think it kind of lives and dies really on whether their finishing can come back to earth or not. I mean, at this moment in time, they're very much the kind of Brighton of the Euros. 12 goals from 14 non-penalty XG. The only side is worse than that. The tournament has been Scotland, who scored 1 goal from 4 XG. So, yeah, I think that'll be the key. I don't think they'll struggle to create chances. I think, as Michael said earlier, kind of they have a very good attacking structure. If they can get Alba in, and I think that Di Lorenzo on that right-hand side is in for another, you know, kind of busy evening. And it's a slightly different threat because with Spain, they're going to try and manipulate you with possession, then open up a pocket of space for a crossing. I think that that'll be key to controlling Alba. But I do think that they're probably susceptible a bit in transition. And we saw Bonucci and Chiellini's kind of long distance, you know, passing range in the last game. And I think that could be a big factor. So yeah, I would like to think that Spain have got enough to control it. But I think if we're being honest, I think Italy probably have got this given their defensive record. And I think they're a bit more comfortable playing in transition as well.
Pray for Robert Sanchez if Spain underperform their XG and lose this one, because as the Brighton goalkeeper and Spain's third choice at this tournament, I'm a little worried that they're going to start treating him like a witch in the old days, start wondering if he's got some sort of curse on him of XG underperformance. One to watch anyway. There's an amazing preview of this game written by James Horncastle and Dermot Corrigan on the Athletic site. And one of the lines that stuck out to me was, never before have these teams looked more alike. Never before have Italy given the impression of speaking fluent Spanish in midfield. Michael, we got some magnificent midfield players on show at Wembley on Tuesday night, from Jorginho and Busquets at the respective bases to Verratti and Pedri kind of doing it all. That midfield area is going to be a joy to watch.
Yeah, definitely. It's a nice line and absolutely true. I think Italy have taken a lot of inspiration from Spain over the last decade, going back really to the Cesare Prandelli days, where he kind of introduced a more technical element to their midfield. And yeah, it's going to be a really interesting game. I think it will be, I think viewers might have to be patient, if we can put it that way. I think both sides will be looking to retain the ball rather than create goal-scoring chance after goal-scoring chance. I think both sides, particularly Spain, like to defend with the ball. But yeah, it should be really interesting. And it's one of those games, maybe we'll have to wait and see how the final goes. But this could be the big game of this tournament, you know, a little bit like Spain-Germany in 2010, where they were probably stronger than the Netherlands side that reached the final. Maybe even France-Belgium 3 years ago, actually, looking back. So yeah, I think this is a potentially real great game.
Because I was expecting you to suggest that there'd be spells of possession for both sides, patient possession. And then on the flip side of that, the question is always for me, well, could the opposition side spring and hurt the team in possession in transition on the counter-attack. And it felt like Belgium had quite a lot of joy in transition against Italy in the quarterfinal. Three or four quite good opportunities, certainly two before they went behind. But even when behind, when Italy were holding on to their lead, they still managed to create a few good counter-attacking opportunities. I wanted to ask whether you thought Spain had it in them to hurt Italy in that way. But you've both mentioned that actually you'd lean towards Italy having the edge in transition as well.
Yeah, I think so. I'm not quite sure that Spain have a player like Barella, who's such a kind of forward runner. They do actually tend to use a kind of similar midfield structure, the two sides, in the sense they both play 4-3-3, but they tend to play with the sitting midfielder, but then one of the other two midfielders drops deep to kind of join them in the build-up play and the other one pushes on. So that's quite an interesting thing, I think, to compare. I think it might be Koke coming deep for Spain while Pedri maintains a little bit of a higher position. So probably Pedri will have more responsibility in counter-attacking situations. But I think Italy are both more secure defensively and potentially a little bit better on the counter-attack as well.
Yeah, I probably agree with that. I think just the wingers for Italy are far more geared to doing that probably in Serie A. Like, that is the game of Insigne at times, is to carry the ball over long distances. It's the game of Chiesa, it's also that of Berardi, and I'd be intrigued to see whether Berardi does get back into the starting lineup or if Chiesa keeps his place, because again, we spoke last time about expected threat and this kind of metric which helps us look at quality of moving the ball either through passing or carrying into higher value positions, and I think Berardi was like the third best player in the tournament when it comes to carrying and his passing, so he's been really good. I don't think he's quite got the plaudits back at home, but the fancy underlying numbers really, really rate him.
That's interesting. Yeah, I feel like he probably hasn't had his big moment yet, but perhaps that'll come in this semi-final. So many options, Italy, in those wide forward positions.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
England against Denmark on Wednesday night, also at Wembley. Denmark reached the semi-final with a 2-1 win over the Czech Republic. Michael, they were heavy favourites for this game, Denmark, and they delivered. They are on a real winning streak as well. What was, do you think, the most interesting and important takeaways from this quarterfinal?
I didn't think it was the most interesting game in the sense I think Denmark were clearly the better team going into it than the Czech Republic. Probably didn't do anything that special in terms of the way that they played, but it was just more of what we've seen from them in terms of, you know, the 3-4-3 formation that they've shifted to after, you know, after what happened to Eriksen. I think they've adjusted to that very well. We know that in a previous game, they were able to put Christensen into the holding midfield role and play 4-3-3. I think they're really well organised. And despite the fact they scored two goals, I'd still have a question mark about their forward three. I thought they had opportunities on the break to really put this game out of sight and they didn't. I think that might be a problem against England, or if they do get to the final, maybe a problem in the final. I just don't think they have the real individual quality of the other three sides left in this competition. But certainly in terms of having ball-playing defenders, in terms of two midfielders on the same wavelength, and a couple of wing-backs who have had a great impact throughout this tournament. I mean, the assist from Mailer for the second goal was just extraordinary. And I mean, Tom's already done an article so far in this tournament about right-footed left-backs and left-wing-backs. That was one solution to it, wasn't it? Just use the outside of your right foot like that.
I did wonder if it was going to be an issue at times of if you push your kind of wrong footer that far up the pitch and they've not got a very, very strong left foot. But like you say, he managed to find a solution. But I do think against England, I wonder if Denmark actually put Mailer on the right flank just because they can get in behind Luke Shaw a bit more and attack that space versus having to go one against one with Kyle Walker, who is going to win that foot race, and you're not going to get a lot of joy there. So I'd be intrigued to see if that happens, especially with Mailer being a more dominant right footer as well.
That's a very interesting point. Tom, this game, any standout numbers, any standout players for you?
I think players wise for Denmark, it's probably Mailer. For England, I mean, I was really impressed with Declan Rice in the game against Ukraine. I thought that Ukraine on the night weren't great, but I thought Rice made England's night a lot easier. Just he read the game really well. He picked up some interesting spaces in build up as well, sometimes filling in a kind of the left side of the back three, and just him and Phillips, I feel, just have a really good game understanding. And it was quite a nice moment when Henderson comes on. I think it was noted in commentary, like, Henderson has to be so calm and patient because he's not getting picked over these two guys who are in their early 20s and they're both just masters of their positions, really. So yeah, I think Rice and Phillips really to match Højbjerg and Delaney. I think they've both got more quality technically, tactically, maybe not physically. I think Højbjerg's a bit of a beast at times. But yeah, I think those two will be key to controlling the game.
Michael, you liked the look of Denmark pre-tournament. And I love the wrinkle that their manager, Kasper Hjulmand, wouldn't have been in charge had the tournament gone ahead last year. Åge Hareide was still in charge then, but you felt that Hjulmand was a better fit for this side. The one thing you did flag up in your preview, which you've mentioned just then, is perhaps, you know, their weakest area is right at the top of the pitch. Now, so far, they've sort of got around that by scoring a fair few goals, and they've shared the creative and scoring burden around. They've had 7 different goal scorers, 6 different assist makers. I mean, can you second guess? You know, you've done very well picking Southgate's changes in strategy. Do you know Hjulmand well enough? How do you think Denmark will approach this game against England? Because we're all very focused on the England side of things always, but, you know, the strength that England have and the personnel particularly, it makes me think that Denmark are probably going to be quite reactive in their game plan.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, we've seen what they do. They play 3-4-3, and if Christensen needs to play in that holding midfield role, then they can do that, and the wing backs move back to become a fullback. So I think that's probably the potential variation they have. Of course, this is all a variation from what they planned. They planned to really base the side around Eriksen, so they're almost on their plan B and plan C already. With Southgate, I don't know what he'll do. Actually, I think this is his biggest decision of the tournament so far. I think it was quite an obvious choice to go 3-4-3 against Germany, and they did that very well. I've got a sneaky suspicion he might do the same, actually, because I think England pressed really well against Ukraine. I think they'll want to do the same again. And Southgate really talked about kind of matching up Germany, wanting to press them high up the pitch. And if you're trying to press 3 centre-backs and then a midfield band of 4, I think you're almost best off playing, you know, 3 attackers, 4 midfielders yourself. I'm probably reasonably comfortable that England can cope 3-on-3 against these Danish forward. So I think a lot of people would view it as a negative move if England do go back to 3-4-3, because it will essentially mean bringing in another defensive player for, I would guess, Sancho, maybe Mount, but probably Sancho. But if England do that with a view to pressing aggressively high up the pitch, then it's not a defensive move. So it's tricky. You can also make the argument that England played very well against Ukraine. They should keep the same side intact. They should be confident of going out and outplaying the opposition.
I was going to say, Ukraine also play a 3 at the back and had packed their midfield, and England went 4-2-3-1. This is the focus of your match report on the Athletic site. It was all about how aggressively England pressed them and how the shape with and without the ball worked really well against Ukraine's formation.
Yeah, I agree. Although I think it's different when you play against a 3-5-2 as Ukraine do, because I think if you press with your 3 high up the pitch, you've then got an issue where your 2 central midfield players would be pressing a 3 in the middle of Ukraine. So I think that's why he didn't do it for that game. And yeah, you can make the opposite argument that England should go out and be confident in their approach and outplay the opposition, but that doesn't seem to be what Southgate's about in this tournament. He's been chopping and changing, as we know, and my suspicion is that he might do the same again.
Tom, did the numbers back up what we all saw basically from kickoff? England aggressively pressing Ukraine, maybe trying to take advantage of a difference in essentially exhaustion levels after Ukraine's output against Sweden in the round of 16. But, you know, Michael's written about it. It was very, very clear. England, unlike in previous games, really went after the opposition.
Yeah, so what we saw from England against Ukraine, I mean, we see them, they don't actually press too high in terms of PPDA, or at least that's what the numbers suggest. I mean, the highest PPDA, which is the number of passes that England allow the opposition to attempt before they look to intercept or tackle or foul, or, you know, generally try and win the ball back. The highest press by this measure is against Scotland, which was a PPDA of around 14. The lowest was around Germany, which is about 26, and then that rose a little bit against Ukraine to 23, but still not overly a kind of intense press all the time. I think there were just moments when they looked at attacking packs. And we saw, I mean, in the previous games, they've won possession in the opposition third 6 times against Croatia, 3 times against Scotland, 6 times against the Czechs, just once against Germany. So again, I think they were a lot more reactive sitting back. And against Ukraine, that rebound again to 5 possessions kind of regained the final third. But I think the most interesting stat, which mainly looks at, there are times where the opposition will turn the ball over, but there won't be a tackle or interception. And Michael used this in his piece, which I thought was really nice, which is the amount of progress the opponent makes per possession that they have. So against Scotland, interestingly, we allowed the Scots 26 metres of progress on average per possession, which is a lot. That's nearly a quarter of the pitch, right? Against Ukraine, we only allowed them 11 metres of progress, which is the lowest of any kind of England opponent so far. So when England, or when Ukraine did have the ball, England were doing enough to kind of suppress them from moving the ball forward. So yeah, I'm intrigued to see how we deal with it against Denmark. I think Michael's right that Southgate won't just suddenly take the handbrake off and just, you know, go hell for the leather. I think that he's always been quite tactically astute, and that'll be the same here. And just because it was kind of, you know, the throttle was opened up a bit in one game doesn't mean that he'll do that for the rest of the tournament. So I do think we'll try and match them tactically, and if he thinks that they can press them and try and win the ball back in a director kind of way, then they'll do it. If not, they won't. So I think that they're a very interesting kind of tactical chameleon under Southgate, and have a lot of different facets, and that's what makes this England side so interesting.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League One? FX is Welcome to Wrexham. Catch all new episodes Thursdays on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. One thing left over and still very much present from World Cup 2018, set-piece threat. It was four games without a set-piece goal, actually, for England before Saturday night, but we always knew it was coming. It was London bus territory, too, within about 15 minutes of each other.
Yeah, I think we called it on the pod, saying that Ukraine conceded the most corners, and obviously Henderson scored from the Mount outswinger. But yeah, I think now 32% of England's shots, so effectively a third of them are coming from set-pieces, so yeah, again, that set-piece threat has definitely remained the same, and that's the most of any team at the Euros.
Are Denmark also quite sturdy on this front, attacking or defending set-pieces? I know they have a specific set-piece guru, like many teams do, a chap whose name evades me, but I know was heavily involved in the Michelin success, which was heavily predicated on set-pieces a few years ago.
Yeah, there was some talk around how the kind of evolution of this Danish side, or why they're such a surprise, comes from the fact that a lot of the Danish clubs have really embraced innovation both on and off the pitch, and I think we've seen that a bit with their set pieces. I mean, they've only had 15% of their shots come from set pieces, but I think that they're a fairly kind of shot happy side overall. The numbers may not always come up from that, and even looking at kind of the XG per set piece on average, they're around eighth out of all teams, and I think their goals per corner ratio is about 1 in 30, which is about average. So we've not seen too much, but I think the routines we have seen that have worked was like the Delaney goal against the Czechs, which he essentially just had a free header. And I think sometimes it's kind of hard to tease out whether it's like a genius, smart set piece routine or just genuinely bad defending by the opposition. But then you also have to question, is that bad defending from the routine in the first place? So I think they're a little bit of a threat there. I think the issue for England really is that they've got Kjær, Vestergaard, Christensen, Højbjerg, Delaney. Like, the latter two aren't that big, but I just think they do have players in there, especially with Poulsen and Dolberg, who are, you know, tall as well and good in the air, that this could be like the hardest side for them to kind of create from a set piece from. But
you can tell Tom himself is a tall man, because he just described Thomas Delaney as not that big. I mean, I think he's absolutely huge.
How big is he? Is he? I'm not sure.
Let's find out. One meter 82. So what's that? 6 foot.
Six, yeah.
Around.
Yeah.
I'm not having that. I think I've got a better eye test than whatever Google says. online player heights are an absolute disgrace. I think we all know that by now. Michael, if Denmark choose to play a reactive game plan, if they will look to draw England onto them and try and use the I know you said that they squandered a few of those opportunities against Czech Republic, but that front three that started with Poulsen coming off the bench, it is mostly speedy and skillful. So if Denmark are going to look to create transition opportunities, I mean, Frank Lampard did quite an interesting piece of analysis in the build-up to this game about how England and Southgate, that is something that they think about a lot, and whether it's in Walker playing a slightly more conservative role or Rice very actively filling gaps left by Luke Shaw, for example, that is something that, you know, England are presumably planning on making sure they do not get caught cold by a Denmark counter-attack.
Yeah, you'd like to think so. I think the central midfielders will probably sit quite deep, as you say. Damsgaard is the one I'd be most afraid of, really. I think Dolberg, a centre-back, should be able to cope with him. Braithwaite is very quick, but if it's Kyle Walker playing there, I would think that he could deal with him. But Damsgaard's movement is very good. He comes inside into pockets of space. He can drive forward with the ball. So that's the one where I would be a little bit concerned by. And I don't think there's anything wrong with the side who doesn't have an out-and-out centre-forward or an out-and-out goal scorer. Like you say, Ali, they have spread the goals around. But I think Denmark might need to keep a clean sheet if they're to win this game in 90 minutes or 120 minutes, because I don't think they will regularly cause a danger going in behind. But they do have a very good defence, a really good system without the ball. I think they will be tough to break down. So in different ways, I think both semi-finals could be quite slow-burning affairs, but both should be good games.
You've predicted all of Flexi Gareth's formation changes so far. I know you said that this was the toughest of the lot, but could I get a predicted formation and any predicted changes ahead of this one? Because that's been quite a fun wrinkle for me of England's tournament so far.
I think he might go 3-4-3 with the Germany system. Maybe, I think the question mark then would be on the right. It could be Saka, could be Sancho, could be Mount. But I think he will look to press, and I think 3-4-3 is probably the best system for pressing this Danish side. And quick addition to that, if he does go for Mount and then the Danes do put Christensen as their holding midfielder and go back to a back four, then Mount would be comfortable in that number 10 role, pressing Christensen in that position as well. So I think that is why he might start instead of Saka. Or Saka could do it, to be fair, but maybe that's why Sancho might not start. But that is just a guess. Like I say, I think this is his most difficult decision so far. So I'm not at all confident on that prediction.
Tom, your crystal ball is actually pointing towards a Danish tactical tweak, which I loved. Really interesting point about their positioning of Myler when it comes to exploiting how England use their fullbacks.
Yeah, I just don't think that Strigger Larsson, or I think Daniel Vass also plays on the right, I just don't think that they will offer enough in behind. And we spoke about Myler before being really key to ball progression for the Danes, but I just wonder if they'll use him more as a runner in behind. And I think we saw him against, was it Wales, late into the game. He popped up on the right and I think he scored from that position. So yeah, I'd be intrigued how they try and counteract England likely playing a back three and likely playing Kyle Walker on that right side, because Myler is super important for them and you don't want to block him out of the game by putting him in a position where he's not going to be very effective.
Two huge games, the semi-finals of Euro 2020 this week. We hope you enjoy them as much as we've enjoyed chatting about them. Of course, there's so much good preview content on the Athletic site. I mentioned Stu James's piece, looking back at the Italy-Belgium game, specifically the gamesmanship of Italy, but that Horncastle and Corrie piece, I thought was brilliant this morning. James Horncastle clearly very excited at the moment, as he has every right to be in fine form. Some of his metaphors in that piece were brilliant. He called Jorginho plays like the white-gloved traffic warden stood on a pedestal amid the honking horn of Rome's Piazza Venezia. And then said about Verratti, he draws the attention of opponents like that piece of burrata cheese everyone round the table keeps trying to put a fork into, only for it to slide away on a slick glistening film of olive oil and balsamic vinegar. Go and read that piece and sign up to The Athletic if you haven't already. TheAthletic.com/zonalmarking is where you can go to get a really good offer at the moment. You'll pay just £1 a month for the first 6 months of your annual subscription. We need to make our plans for pre-match, the big Zonal Marking podcast outing on Tuesday night at Spain versus Italy. What a true privilege that is to be watching that game in the flesh. We'll be breaking down that plus England against Denmark on Thursday, no doubt. So watch out for this podcast to drop then. The next episode of the Zonal Marking Euros Notebook will be out on Thursday. We'll speak to you then. Go well.
The Athletic.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.